Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the opening of the Cuban embassy in Washington and talk with a former chief U.S. diplomat in Cuba from 1999 to 2002, Ambassador Vicki Huddleston. She joins us to discuss the new U.S. charge d'affaires in Cuba, our man in Havana, Jeffrey De Laurentiis, who worked with her during turbulent times between the U.S. and Cuba when Fidel Castro and Miami Cubans were tussling over a Cuban boy, Elian Gonzalez, who was picked up at sea in the Florida Straits. We will discuss the long overdue reestablishment of diplomatic ties between the closest of enemies and the prospects for building on them. Then we'll go to Havana, Cuba, and speak with Mark Frank, who works for Thomson Reuters and the Financial Times and is the author of Cuba Revelations, Behind the Scenes in Havana. We will discuss how much Cuba's failing economy was a factor in breaking the more than five decades-long hostility since, according to Cuba's official data, its GDP in 2013 was $77.2 billion at the official exchange rate, but using the internal exchange rate of 24 pesos to the dollar, Cuba's GDP could be as low as $3.2 billion. Then finally, we will look into the suicide bombing in the Turkish town of Suruk near the Syrian border, which killed 30 and wounded 100, mostly young Kurdish members of the Federation of Socialist Youth Associations, meeting to plan to go to Kobani to help rebuild the nearby town devastated by fighting between the Islamic State and Kurdish fighters supported by U.S. air power. Henri Baki, the director of the Middle East program at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars, joins us to discuss whether this incident will force Turkey to confront the Islamic State, which has benefited from Turkey's inaction in preventing jihadist recruits from crossing through Turkey to join ISIL in Syria. And joining us now from Haiti is Ambassador Vicki Huddleston, who served as a career diplomat in Africa and Latin America. She was a U.S. ambassador to Madagascar and to Mali, as well as Deputy Assistant Secretary for Africa, and was the chief U.S. diplomat in Cuba from 1999 to 2002 and deputy chief of mission in Port-au-Prince, Haiti from 1994 to 1995. She's received various State Department awards, including the Distinguished Honor Award and a Presidential Meritorious Service Award. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ambassador Vicki Huddleston.
Yeah, it's nice to be with you.
And I guess your deputy from your days in Havana, Jeffrey De Laurentiis, is now our man in Havana, right?
That's absolutely right. It's just amazing, and it's such a good thing. Not only the fact that we've established a new relationship, a formal relationship with Cuba, but that it's Jeff who's in charge of that relationship in Havana.
And he's head of mission. I take it he's, for all intents and purposes, he's an ambassador, but that would require congressional approval, right?
It's exactly the same thing. Now that it's an embassy. So it's an embassy. He's in charge of the embassy. But since Congress probably wouldn't approve an ambassador, at least there would be some pretty substantial opposition from Cuban-American senators, just gets a different title. I'm sorry he doesn't get the real ambassador title, but he actually was an ambassador at the UN, so he has been an ambassador, and obviously he will carry out the functions of an ambassador in this new job.
So the time that you were there was some fairly substantial problems between the U.S. and Cuba. There was, of course, the Elian Gonzalez issue, and the U.S. interest section of the former embassy sits there on the seafront promenade, the Malecón, and of course, right across the street back in the days that you were there, an anti-imperialist stand was built opposite. And were you were there at the time that the U.S. put up its sort of, you know, flashing billboard that was then obscured?
No, that's not me. That's my successor, Jim Kaysen. But when I was there, it was the little Elian Gonzalez crisis, and he was the five-year-old child who was found floating on an inner tube in Florida States. He was taken to Miami. He then went to his relatives, and at that point, the relatives, with a lot of encouragement from the Cuban-American community, said they wanted him to stay in the United States. So we had this really famous custody battle between really Fidel Castro and the Cuban-American community, and Fidel won. Elian went back, which is right under international law since his father wanted him back. We did interviews with the father, so we knew it was a good, loving family, and it was the right thing to do. But it was a big defeat and a major shock for the Cuban-American community.
And how much of a role did Jeffrey De Laurentiis play in that?
Oh, well, Jeff was very much my advisor, very much involved. He, of course, had a background in Cuba. He had served there before. He understood the Cubans. Jeff and I used to meet regularly with Ricardo Alarcón, who was the number four, more or less, in the Cuban hierarchy, and he was Fidel Castro's point person on all things to do with the United States. So, for example, Jeff and I had to talk to the Cubans about whether or not we should go ahead with the migration talks, which were scheduled for mid-December. Elian, of course, was picked up on Thanksgiving Day. When the Cubans or Fidel began to organize his huge marches, the State Department was very nervous. You know, Jeff, from his experience, said there's nothing to worry about, and I reassured the State Department. Although I have to tell you, that story was kind of funny. I told them, the State Department, not to worry, but the spokesperson couldn't really resist, so he said, "We expect the Cubans to protect the security of our diplomats." And so the next day, when the march was going to take place, Fidel sent about 200 school children in their pioneer uniforms to surround the intersection and protect us from the Cuban crowd.
So, again, I'm speaking with Ambassador Vicki Huddleston, who served as a career diplomat in Africa and Latin America. She was a U.S. ambassador to Madagascar and to Mali, as well as Deputy Assistant Secretary for Africa, and was the chief U.S. diplomat in Cuba from 1999 to 2002, and Deputy Chief of Mission in Port-au-Prince, Haiti from 1994 to 1995. She has received various Department of State awards, including the Distinguished Honor Award and a Presidential Meritorious Service Award. So, but the new U.S. ambassador, Jeffrey De Laurentiis, in Havana, he was also there during the period of the shock transition that Cuba underwent when the Soviet Union pulled out its support and cut its subsidies, and Cuba more or less had to become incredibly self-sufficient until Hugo Chavez came to the rescue with energy supplies.
Right. You know, we always think of Cuba as always having a major supporter. Of course, Spain was the colonial power, replaced by the United States replaced by the Soviet Union, and then the Soviet Union replaced by Venezuela. And now, hopefully, with Jeff there and a new relationship, a positive relationship, we'll see Cuba become more like a normal country, not with any major supporter, with lots of friends, obviously, in Latin America and the developing world, but, you know, a country that can develop its own resources. And that's one of the big things Cuba needs to do now, because it has such a wealth of talent. Cubans are really very creative people. They're obviously really well educated, and now they just need to have that opportunity to develop their own businesses and to make better salaries. $20, obviously, a month is not a salary, a livable salary, although they receive many benefits from the government. But if you really want to stimulate the economy and see Cuba take off, which I think it could, then the government really has to loosen up and allow private investment, venture capital, and give Cubans an opportunity just to show what they can do in an open economy. So I think that will be one of Jeff's challenges, is to work with the Cuban government to help them understand or participate in a more open economy that has more opportunity for their people.
Well, already there's a big venture. I think the Chinese are involved in developing a big megaport But there's also a downside, is there not, Ambassador Huddleston, the possibility of all of those pristine beaches, all of those forests that have been protected, the reefs, the coral, etc. Some of Cuba is apparently the last of some of the Caribbean reefs, etc., that haven't been hurt. So is there a possibility of a kind of gold rush? Are we going to see hotels on pristine beaches, do you think?
Oh, I hope not. You know, it's a great point you point out, and it's a really, really important point, because Cuba is actually the hatchery for the whole Caribbean because of its pristine reefs, as you say. And it's really incredibly important that United States research institutions work with the Cubans, like the Finley Research Institute in Havana, which is one of the oldest in the Western Hemisphere. There's Botanical Gardens in Havana and Cienfuegos. We have worked in the past with the Cubans on research vessels in the ocean. So this, I would imagine, would be a real priority for Jeff in his position of leading the intersection, because it's extremely valuable for Cuba, for the United States, and indeed for the whole Caribbean region.
And why do you think this deal was made? I mean, to some extent, it seems that since Raul Castro took over, the brother was seen as more palatable. Am I right in that? I mean, and also I'm not entirely sure about what it was that drove the Cubans to basically make this deal, because presumably, just as we have hardliners here, and you've mentioned the Cuban-American senators and others who are resisting this deal, I assume that the Castro brothers have hardliners in their country who don't want to bury the hatchet with the Yankee imperialists.
Well, yeah, it's probably mainly in the military, but I think Cuba was driven to it because of its economic situation. It's clear that Venezuela isn't going to be able to sustain indefinitely providing the quantity of oil that they're providing on a daily basis to Cuba. Secondly, Raul had already begun downsizing the number of Cubans that are employed by the state, by the Cuban state, which of course then means that these people have to have jobs, they have to have investment in income. So I think economics drove the Cubans to do it. Now, my opinion, and I certainly remember talking with Jeff about this when we were there, is that the time for change, for normalizing relations in Cuba, was always in the second term of a president. Because in the first term, because Florida is so incredibly important to the presidential elections, and because the Cuban-American vote is so important as well, a sitting president is always unwilling to do it. But in the second term, there's that opportunity. And Clinton was headed in that direction. He had the new measures. Remember the baseball exchanges with the Baltimore Orioles and the Baltimore Orioles played in Cuba, and then the Cubans played in Baltimore. And so Cuba and the United States were headed that direction. But then little Elian was found at sea, and Castro saw this as an opportunity to renew his revolution, put himself back on the world stage, and in fact just defeat his arch enemies, the hardline Cuban-Americans.
And do you think they're defeated now? That logic, reason, after 50-plus years, the fact that there's been so much tourism and exchange between Cuban-Americans and Cubans, which I believe they come over with tons and tons of goods and stuff. And it's always, I mean, the main argument against the blockade, one of the main arguments against the blockade has been that it's actually kept the Castros in power. Do you subscribe to that school of thought?
Yes, I think the embargo, particularly the communications embargo, because, you know, you weren't getting, Cuba has 5% internet coverage. You know, if it had been, if we hadn't had an embargo that covered communications, maybe Cuba would have had 50%. And so we helped the security services limit Cubans' access to information and communications. I believe that change would have come much faster, and it would have been gradual and peaceful had the United States not had the embargo. So now I think there's immense opportunity. And the Cuban people are so enthusiastic. I was there in May, and they were all talking to me about, oh, do you think this is going to work? We're so hopeful. We really want the opportunities that we believe will come with normalization and more Americans coming to Cuba, and obviously the hope for more investment, too.
Well, of course, we are we're approaching an election year, but for all intents and purposes, we're already in the 2016 elections with the first Republican primary debate coming up in a few weeks. And two of the main Republican candidates, Marco Rubio, the senator from Florida, and Jeb Bush, the former governor, are running. I don't know whether at the end of the day there would be a Bush-Rubio ticket, because I believe there's been a falling out between the mentor and his protege. But this is to say that there's a certain amount of anti-Castro clout in our politics at the moment. And do you think it has the ability to derail the progress made by Obama and Raul Castro?
I think that's why the United States and this administration really have to move rapidly. Because if there was a Rubio or a Jeb Bush as president, they could well begin to try to roll this back. And that would be really unfortunate for the Cuban people and for the American people, because it isn't really an issue of win and lose. I think the Cuban people win by this. I think the American people win by this. Obviously, most of Latin America is really delighted with the United States, so the United States wins in its diplomatic relations. Overall, I think it'll be really hard for the Cuban government, because they're going to have to make this really difficult transition to essentially a much more open society, both on the human rights and democracy side, as well as on the economic side. And these are hard transitions that they're faced with. So I don't think the Cuban Americans should feel like they've lost. They should feel like they have a chance now to once again connect with their old country.
Well, I was just speaking earlier today with Bill Goodfellow from the Center for International Policy, who was at the opening of the Cuban embassy in Washington, D.C., and he said he ran into a group of Texas oil men that were celebrating at the reception, and they can't wait to get in there and develop offshore oil. So what about this idea that the U.S. has sort of missed the boat, that during this long period of estrangement, that the Canadians have been active there, the Spaniards have been active there? Is that your sense, that the U.S. is going to have to play catch-up with other international investors?
Yes, very definitely. And in fact, I think the oil is really, really important, because we have the latest technology. We're close to Cuba. We have the most to lose if there's a spill or anything like that. We have the cleanup technology. It really should be a major American oil firm that is exploiting with the Cubans the oil. And maybe they would actually find it, because the U.S. Geological Survey indicates the oil is there, but so far none of the international firms that have been involved in exploration have actually found it. But, I mean, this is a good example of what the United States should be doing.
Well, Ambassador Vicki Huddleston, I thank you very much for joining us. I take it, just in general, you sound like you're pretty excited about this change. It's certainly been a long time in coming.
Yes, over a half century in coming. And it's sad, because that it comes sooner, I think change would have come to Cuba sooner, but it's come now. Cuba has a huge opportunity to be the leader of the Caribbean, if not Latin America, to enter the modern world. And the United States has a chance to once again be a friend and a mentor to Cuba. So I'm really looking forward to seeing this, and I'm very glad that such a wise professional diplomat like Jeff is going to be in charge of this transition for us in Havana. So thanks, Ian.
And I thank you again. And I've been speaking with Ambassador Vicky Huddleston, who served as a career diplomat in Africa and Latin America. She was a U.S. ambassador to Madagascar and to Mali, as well as Deputy Assistant Secretary for Africa, and was the chief U.S. diplomat in Cuba from 1999 to 2002, and Deputy Chief of Mission in Port-au-Prince, Haiti from 1994 to 1995. She's received various Department of State awards, including a Distinguished Honor Award and a Presidential Meritorious Service Award. We're going to take a brief station break and back and go to Havana, Cuba, for an analysis on Cuba's economy. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now from Havana, Cuba, is Mark Frank, a freelance journalist based in Cuba who works for Thomson Reuters and the Financial Times and consults for ABC News. He's contributed to The Economist and Argentina's Clarín and is the author of Cuba Looks to the Year 2000 and Cuba Revelations Behind the Scenes in Havana. Welcome to Background Briefing, Mark Frank.
Hi, good afternoon, at least here.
So, Mark, The Cuban embassy opened today in Washington, D.C., but I take it the American embassy in Havana is not going to officially fly the U.S. flag until John Kerry pays a visit there on August the 14th. Is that your understanding?
Right, that's correct. As of today, relations have, of course, been restored, and the building here is, of course, an embassy. But the official ceremony, where they raise the flag and all that, won't happen for another couple of weeks.
So what's the expectation in terms of the economy? Because the Pew Research Center quoted official Cuban data saying that the nation's GDP for 2013 was 77.2 billion Cuban pesos. And the official exchange rate, of course, is $1 equals 1 peso, which would make their GDP in 2013 $77.2 billion. But the unofficial rate, the internal rate for the peso, is about 24 to the dollar. And if you converted it, then the GDP would only be about $3.2 billion, which is essentially what Donald Trump claims he's worth.
Well, you know, welcome to Cuba, where there's a lot of confusion. Because you do have two currencies, you do have different exchange rates. So it's all, I think, somewhat of an estimate at this point. But clearly, when we say the, what was it, 80 billion or 70 billion, it's closer than the 3.2 billion. Most people think the average income here, at least on paper, is about $5,000 a year per Cuban. That's probably close to the truth and a lot less. But again, you know, exactly how much, hard to say. What we all know is that Cuba is going through quite a crisis for the last 20 years since the fall of the Soviet Union. And though things are better, they are clearly flat broke and much in need of an end to the embargo and better relations with us.
And at this point, Cuba's major sources of income are tourism, which is 10% of the GDP last year, remittances from family and relatives in the U.S., that's estimated about $3 billion last year. And of course, these oil subsidies from Venezuela make an enormous difference, do they not? That's about 100,000 barrels of oil daily. And recently, of course, Russia's President Vladimir Putin forgave the $32 billion in Cuban debt dating back to the Soviet times. So without Venezuela, I take it, Cuba would really be in trouble.
Sure, but on the other hand, one has to be careful because they'd be in trouble if oil prices were still over $100 a barrel, but of course now they're out of $50 a barrel. And really, since Raul Castro's come into power, Cuba has branched out quite a bit. So yes, there are still doctors in Venezuela that Cuba makes money from. Their biggest money earner, by the way, is the export of doctors and professional services, which is about $5.5 billion. A lot of that comes from Venezuela, but of course now they have 12,000 doctors in Brazil, 1,000 doctors in Ecuador. They have a lot of doctors now in the Middle East. They have 4,000 in Angola. So they have branched out quite a bit. So certainly it would be a problem for them, but nothing compared to what happened when the Soviets fell.
Well, of course, the fact that they have so many doctors and a surplus that they can export to Brazil and to Venezuela also leads you to the fact that they also have invested incredibly in education. And Cuba is 99.8% of its island's population over the age of 15 can read and write, which compared to the United States, you know, there are 30 million Americans, which is 14% of the population, who fall below the basic literacy line in terms of these basic skills. So there are obviously great potential there, isn't it? You have an incredibly educated population, which would one would assume that if economic opportunity were provided, the country could really take off.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think that sometimes it's all exaggerated a bit because Cuba is, of course, just an island in the Caribbean. It's not a large country. But certainly without the embargo, there'd be a lot more going on. They would have much better port facilities and the businesses around there. There'd be more tourism. The nickel industry would probably connect with ours because we need nickel and they have a lot of nickel. And on and on. So certainly they'd be doing a whole lot better than they are now. But they're not going to be another United States or another developed capitalist country. They're a small country and they're still a very developing country. And that will remain as such for quite a while, I think. But certainly they will be better off than they are now.
Again, I'm speaking with Mark Frank, who is in Havana, Cuba. He's a freelance journalist based there who works for Thomson Reuters and the Financial Times and consults for ABC News and has contributed to The Economist and Argentina's Clarín. He's also the author of Cuba Looks to the Year 2000 and Cuban Revelations Behind the Scenes in Havana. So in terms of, you just mentioned ports, there's a new economic or special economic zone for shipping and container terminal that's been built at the port of Mariel. And so far, five foreign companies, two from Mexico, two from Belgium, and one from Spain, are operating there. I think it might have been, was it the Brazilians who invested it or the Chinese?
Well, neither, actually. What happened was that the Brazilians gave them credits. They lent them money to build the port. Now, the Chinese have nothing to do with the port. It's being now it's being administered by Singapore Ports, which is a very prestigious firm, and recently a very important, one of the most important container companies in the world, a French firm, signed an agreement to do the logistics. Part of the reason for the port is that when the Panama Canal finishes its renovation and those big Chinese ships start going through there, we expect some of them to dock here in Cuba and then move their cargo wherever from here. So that's how China's name got involved. But actually, it was built by the Cubans with the help of a Brazilian company, funded completely by the Brazilians, so it all has to be paid back. And again, Singapore runs it, Singapore Ports.
So is there a sense then that this is all going to go ahead now that the embassy's opened in Washington and the U.S. embassy on the Malecón there, the flag will go up in a couple of weeks with Secretary of State John Kerry's visit. In terms of the Cuban people, I mean, they obviously have some expectations, and their expectations have presumably been raised. Do they also have any qualms about America's, that we're in a political year, or at least, you know, we're already having elections, and it's not until next year, but you know how long the elections go here. So effectively, we are in an election season already. And the latest polls from Florida say that have Jeb Bush beating Marco Rubio by 43% to 31% amongst Cuban-American Republicans. But either way, you know, Governor Bush and Senator Rubio, both of Florida, are big political players in this election cycle. So what's the sense there in Havana and in Cuba of whether the Republicans could reverse all of what has recently taken place?
Okay, well, I guess it's kind of the same sense you get if you were a Cuban in general, because the country gets hit on average by a hurricane every 2 years. So Cubans get their hopes up and a hurricane comes along and smashes everything. So I would say probably the Cuban people are very hopeful. They think this is very positive, but certainly they're wary. When you talk to Cubans, you'll find that 95% or more of them support exactly what's going on. But they have two worries. One worry is that the government somehow won't do the job needed for it to continue to progress the relationship. And another is that, in fact, the U.S. will backtrack, or the U.S. somehow will take advantage, or whatever. You have to remember 75% of the Cuban people have never lived without the embargo. So it's a bit of, well, okay, what does it mean when it's finally lifted? Nobody's exactly sure. But in general, overwhelming support, certainly there's some anxiety. The Cuban government, of course, makes a point of saying, and so does the U.S. government, that just because diplomatic relations have been restored, that's a long cry, it's a long ways from normal relations, because, of course, the embargo still is in place. And, in fact, the Republican Party is very doubtful they'll be lifting it any time soon, and they control the Congress. So, yes, positive, but certainly everyone's very aware of its limits, just as they are in the United States at this point. I've talked to all kinds of companies from down here in the last 6 months, really the who's who of companies. And they all understand that they're taking a look around, but until things change in terms of our policy, there's a limit to what they can do. And, of course, on the Cuban side, there's a limit as well. So everybody understands there's a long ways to go. But I think most people also understand this is a very important step in the right direction.
Well, is there a possibility that there's more that the president can do through executive action, or do you think he's sort of run out of options?
No, I think there is more he can do. Everybody agrees there's a number of other measures he can take. I mean, we kind of have a situation here now where there's kind of two tracks, the executive track and the congressional track. And I think we'll see Obama and the administration begin to have talks with Cuba and try to use some of those other things that they can do as leverage with the Cubans as they discuss other issues. And I wouldn't be surprised if the Obama administration over the coming year, certainly after the election, before the next president comes into power, if they continue to take measures in the same direction that they've been taking them so far. There's many other things Obama can do. He can lift travel restrictions a lot more. He can allow Cubans and the people in other countries in the world deal with the Cubans in U.S. dollars. He can selectively lift the embargo to allow commercial activity almost across the board. So there's plenty more he can do. On the congressional side, I think the idea is to create enough of a momentum and enough support amongst U.S. people and companies that it's very difficult to backslide, and there will be increasing pressure on Congress to move forward as well. I think so you'll see the executive side trying to keep up the momentum, hopefully with the help of Cubans. And on the congressional side, I think we'll see more and more pressure, though I personally doubt they'll be doing much before the next election.
Well, just in closing, everybody, I think, was caught by surprise that these secret negotiations that had been going on had maintained some secrecy. And, you know, you had the U.S. Senator from Vermont, Patrick Leahy, has also been apparently flying down there quite a bit, having these secret talks. So were you surprised that they were able to pull off these secret negotiations and be able to make this announcement as a fait accompli?
Sure, I think we all were somewhat surprised. I mean, it was clear that something was going on. There was some kind of discussions around the jailed contractor here, the spies, the Cuban spies in the U.S. But the breadth of the decision, the announcement they are actually going to normalize diplomatic ties, I think that took everybody by surprise, or just about everybody.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us. And I take it there's a fairly buoyant mood in Cuba, not that the Cubans aren't a fairly happy bunch of people, Ryan.
Yeah, I mean, somewhat what happens in Cuba is there's a big story and it's blown up around the world. But here, people pretty much, of course, just go about their lives. So nobody's dancing in the street. There's no parties. There's nothing like that going on in Cuba. But certainly everybody is very happy about the development.
Well, Mark Frank, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
A pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Mark Frank, who is in Havana, Cuba, where he's a freelance journalist who works for Thomson Reuters and the Financial Times and consults for ABC News and has contributed to The Economist and Argentina's Clarín. He's the author of Cuba Looks to the Year 2000 and Cuba Revelations Behind the Scenes in Havana. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into whether the suicide bombing in a Turkish town near the Syrian border will change Turkey's attitude towards the Islamic State. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Henri Barki, who's the director of the Middle East Program at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. He served as a member of the United States Department of State's policy planning staff, working primarily on the Middle East, the Eastern Mediterranean, and intelligence, and has authored, co-authored, and edited five books, among them Turkey's Kurdish Question with Graham Fuller and Reluctant Neighbor, Turkey's Role in the Middle East. Welcome to Background Briefing, Henri Barki.
Thank you.
And is it possible that this suicide bombing in the Turkish town of Suruk, which is near Kobani on the Syrian border, could it be a turning point in Turkey's relation with the Islamic State, given that Turkey has actually basically not acted in preventing jihadist recruits from crossing through Turkey to join the Islamic State in Syria? So, at the very least, do you think they're going to plug the Underground Railroad?
Well, I mean, I think they have to. I mean, I think there's going to be a lot of pressure now from not just the outsiders like the United States, but also from within the country, because this is really devastating and, you know, attacking essentially a group of young people so aimlessly is going to be very, very hard in Turkey to explain. The problem is that there's great divisions now in Turkey on this issue. I mean, you have, because the people who were killed were mostly Kurds who were trying to help other Kurds in Kobani, there seems to be a division over ethnicity, if you want. But basically, you're right. I mean, this is going to be, it has to be the beginning of a tightening. I mean, the Turks are facing an important choice now. They have essentially three things they have to do. One is plug the border. But more importantly is that they have to take down this infrastructure that has come into existence in Turkey, an infrastructure that helps ISIS. So imagine, for instance, a Frenchman decides to go and join the jihad, lands in Istanbul, doesn't speak a word of Turkish, and yet he manages to get all the way to Syria and join ISIS. How does that happen? Well, somebody picks him up, somebody gives him puts him in a safe house, transports him, eventually helps him cross the border. All of this takes people, money, right? And that infrastructure exists. In fact, only the other day, on Friday, there was a large group of ISIS supporters who got together for a holiday prayer, and the leader of the group is threatened Turkey in no uncertain terms. He said, "We don't have bombs, we don't have guns, but we have God who's going to punish you." So that infrastructure has to be taken down, and until now, the Turks have been quite reluctant to go after that. Last week, they started essentially they started to arrest people. They closed down some websites and some accounts. But this is only the beginning, and they have to do more. And third, now the United States and the Turks are talking, and what the United States wants is it wants access to the large NATO air force base in southern Turkey, a base called Incirlik, in order to conduct more operations against ISIS. Till now, the Turks have been very, very reluctant. In fact, they've always said no, and they've refused to give the United States access to that base for that purpose. So will they change their mind? I don't think it's going to be immediate, but I think within a month and a half, I suspect that we may see some change in the Turkish position on this, because ISIS now is a threat. I mean, the Turks have to understand that ISIS is a major threat to them. And in a way, the Turks were kind of a reluctant midwife to the creation of ISIS or to the strengthening of ISIS, because as many jihadists cross the border, a lot of them join ISIS, even if they join maybe other groups first, and eventually they migrated to ISIS. And that ISIS is capable, and ISIS is a kind of organization that is ruthless. It will, one day you're your friend, next day you're the enemy, and you're dead. So I think the Turks have to take this very, very seriously, even if the victims were primarily Kurds today.
And these were, the victims were young Kurdish members of the Federation of Socialist Youth Associations.
Right. There may have been also some Turks among them. We don't really know. I mean, sometimes it's hard to tell who those, the ethnic identity of people. But it's possible that there were also Turks. I mean, it may be a multicultural organization for all we knew.
And again, I'm speaking with Henri Baki, who's the director of the Middle East Program at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. He served as a member of the United States State Department's policy planning staff, working primarily on the Middle East, the Eastern Mediterranean, and intelligence, and has authored, co-authored, and edited five books, among them Turkish Kurdish Question with Graham Fuller and Reluctant Neighbor, Turkey's Role in the Middle East. Well, according to Turkey's Prime Minister, Ahmet Davutoğlu, he said at a press conference that Turkey has taken and will continue to take all necessary measures against the Islamic State. Measures on our borders with Syria will be increased. So what does that mean, do you think?
Well, look, what it means is that they will have to be much more vigilant about border crossings. I mean, until recently, there were very loose controls. In fact, the town of Tel Abyad that was taken up by the Syrian Kurds was the Syrian counterpart to the Turkish crossing point where people cross the border willy-nilly. So they will have to be far, far, far more vigilant. But it's not just the border crossings. I mean, the Syrian-Turkish border is long. It's hard to control. So smugglers know their way around. So you really need to invest a great deal of resources. Now, the Turkish army is powerful. The Turkish army has a lot of manpower. If they want to deploy the army, and they can make it very, very difficult for these human smugglers to operate in the region. But that takes a kind of willpower or a decision, political decision on the part of the government to do it. And we have not seen that yet.
Well, is it because the president is somewhat conflicted? He obviously is determined to get rid of the Assads, and the most potent force against the Assads is the Daesh, the Islamic State. And does that explain his ambivalence?
Only partially. I mean, I think he look, the Turkish the Turkish president, when he was prime minister, expected Assad, or that Assad was going to fall quickly. When Assad didn't fall, he wanted the United States to bring Assad down. And we basically said, no, we were not going to get into another Middle East war. So he decided then to support all kinds of jihadists, not ISIS. He supported other guys, al-Nusra and other organizations, including the Free Syrian Army. But the problem is that many of those people eventually migrated to ISIS because ISIS turned out to be far more potent as a force. And it is true that you have sympathizers in Turkey, too, who sympathize with ISIS, who think ISIS is the real thing. But I think Erdogan did not want to be seen as preventing people from going crossing the border to fight Assad. That's the issue. It's not whether or not he wanted ISIS. He just didn't want to stop people from going in to fight ISIS. Assad. I think he probably understands that ISIS is a very dangerous element, but until now he thought that Turkey would be immune from this. The big mistake that Erdogan made was when the town of Kobani came under siege by ISIS. He made it very clear. Now, the town of Kobani was inhabited by Syrian Kurds. He made it very clear that he wanted Kobani to fall, that he'd rather have ISIS control Kobani than the Kurds. And that essentially made people think that he is quite sympathetic to ISIS. And the Turkish press that is close to Erdogan about a month ago and 2 months ago went on this kind of headline rampage where they were arguing that the Syrian Kurds, the organization is called PYD, the Democratic Solution Party, that the Syrian Kurds were more dangerous than ISIS. So they really muddied the waters, very much so. And in some ways, I'm not going to say that they prepared the groundwork for all of this, obviously not, but they created this atmosphere in Turkey that the Kurds were worse than ISIS. And that, I think, is very unfortunate. It doesn't explain the bombing today, but it does explain a little bit the reluctance, if you want, of Erdogan until now to clamp down on the borders, because some of these ISIS guys fight the Kurds. So there is a complicated calculation in his mind. I don't pretend to understand what the Turkish president is thinking at the moment, but he did give this impression, unfortunately, that he was more worried about Kurds than he was worried about ISIS, and that impression lingers and has, for one segment of the Turkish population, has become kind of a battle cry, rallying cry. He has really done a lot of damage to his relationship with a significant segment of the Turkish public.
So in terms of the Turkish public, where are they on Syria? I mean, they don't seem like they want to get more involved, but they've got to be concerned about the mayhem going on their southern border.
Yes, I mean, look, Turkey is a reluctant neighbor in some ways now, again, because they did not want... Turkey was never interested in the Middle East, and under Erdogan, it really got interested in the Middle East, did very well at the beginning, and the Arab Spring came and essentially undermined everything that Erdogan and his government had achieved in the Middle East. And now, but you can't escape geography. I mean, Syria is your next-door neighbor. I don't think anybody could have prevented what happened in Syria. I mean, short of a major invasion of Syria, what could you have done? And if there was an invasion of Syria, then we would have had, whoever did the invasion would have this very serious problems in managing Syria. I mean, look, Iraq should be a warning to everybody. You can't do this. So the Turks now are facing this major insurrection in which has become increasingly bloody and increasingly fundamentalist. And you know, when you're in a neighbor, you get affected by it. You can't escape it. But the, you know, as I said, you know, it had the Turkish government not been so easy in terms of its border controls, maybe, maybe ISIS would not have been this powerful. But look, the Turkish public does not want to go into Syria. The Turkish public doesn't want to see Assad succeed. So they are in many ways not different than us, in the sense that we don't want Assad to stay, but we don't want to go and send American troops. So the Turks don't want to send Turkish troops there. But just like ISIS can come and hit us here, they can also hit Turkey, but it's easier to do it in Turkey because you have a much more extensive infrastructure created by ISIS in Turkey. I mean, that infrastructure must be very, very large to be able to sustain the kind of support that's being given to ISIS in terms of men and materiel. So that's a big challenge for Turkey. How do you take control of these people? And what was interesting about this meeting I mentioned to you on Friday, where the leader of the ISIS supporters literally threatened the Turkish government and said, "You're no different than anybody else who persecutes Muslims." And you know, these are fighting words, and in some ways, you look. Turkey is a country where a lot of people have arms, and violent incidents are likely to happen. But look, I think the challenge for the government now is, having lost its credibility with a segment of the population on this issue, is to devise a unifying message with all the other parties, especially the Turkish Kurdish party, the HDP, and try make, you know, it has to show certain signs that it cares about what happened. You know, on Twitter, there's a very interesting conversation going on. When the king of Saudi Arabia died, a king in another country, the Turkish flag was lowered to half mast. So many Turks are saying, "So we did it for a Saudi king whose name we don't even know. Yet when 31 of our brethren, our citizens die, we can't bring ourselves to lower the flag." Let's say tomorrow the Turkish government were to say we're going to lower the flag to half mast. I think that would be a small sign. It would be, you know, they need to be able to send a message that everybody's in this fight together, and you can't start blaming, "Oh, these were socialists. Oh, these were Kurds. Oh, these were bringing aid and support to Kurds in Syria." I mean, that kind of discourse is very, very divisive, and the government has to rise above it, and the government has to say, "Look, these are all Turkish citizens. The president has to go there, the prime minister has to go there, and show genuine sorrow." Whether or not they can do it, I don't know.
Well, but in Syria itself, as I mentioned earlier, the Islamic State seemed to be making advances on the Assad forces, but for the Iranians, Assad probably would have already gone under, and he's increasingly relying on the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps of the Iranians and the Hezbollah forces. Assad just lost control of Hasaka, which is a capital of a province of Hasaka. He's already lost two other provincial capitals, Raqqa and Idlib. And in the case of Hasaka, he lost that to the YPG Kurdish fighters. So it seems like the Kurdish fighters and the Islamic State, even though they fight each other, they are the biggest threat to Assad. So what happens? Assad's obviously running out of recruits, and surely there's going to be a second Syrian war, isn't there? If Assad is ever defeated.
Look, what you said just reminded me of one very important point I needed to make. Why were these people targeted today? why, if it's IS who did it, if it's Islamic State that did it, they wanted to hurt Kurds, especially Kurds, obviously, who are connected to Syrian Kurds. Why? Because the Syrian Kurds are the only organization to date, with American help, admittedly, who have done significant amount of damage to ISIS. Nobody else has defeated ISIS on the battlefield so far, except the Kurds. So they really, by bombing today, they were essentially killing two birds with one stone. They were first and foremost attacking and punishing the Kurds, right, and then also showing that the Turkish government can control its borders. But so that's one. I would say that, first of all, ISIS, the shall we say, the expansion of ISIS has to some extent been halted. I mean, ISIS is under a great deal of pressure with because of the American bombing, because of the Kurdish attacks with American the American Air Force. I mean, there's a way in which you can think of U.S. Air Force as becoming the Air Force of the Kurds or the PYD, and or the PYD becoming the American ground troops. And the president, actually, President Obama, over a week ago, said a very interesting thing at the Pentagon. He said, we can defeat ISIS provided we have the right partners on the ground. And basically that was both a warning to everybody saying you're not doing enough, and also saying that, look, the Kurds are the ones who have been the good partners here. You're right about Assad losing territory, but the territories that Assad really cares about, which is from Aleppo down to Damascus and the coastal towns of Latakia, etc., those, Aleppo is under pressure, but you know, that's what he cares about. Whether or not he loses Idlib or Hasaka is not important to him. They're too far away. The lines of communication are too dangerous. He needs to concentrate and stay in power in the Alawite heartland of Syria. And that he might be able to do for a long time to come.
Well, Henri Bakke, I thank you very much for joining us. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Henri Bakke, who's the director of the Middle East Program at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. He served as a member of the U.S. State Department's policy planning staff, working primarily on the Middle East, the Eastern Mediterranean, and intelligence, and has authored and co-authored and edited five books, among them Turkey's Kurdish Question with Graham Fuller and Reluctant Neighbor, Turkey's Role in the Middle East. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.